session number 12663, Reel 3.
Colonel Watchmore, Reel 3.
There were stories of them flying flags, but I think that was more a question of signalling than of psychological warfare. I don't think there were any other tricks that the Chinese got up to.
Did they scream as they went into the attack?
Well, it was so noisy that I didn't hear any of them if they did.
What was the worst moment in the whole Imjin affair for you personally, do you think?
I think having to withdraw from my original position. We'd been put there to hold it. And I can recall the company commander saying, as he sighted the position well before the battle, "I'm putting you in the forward position." But it was impossible to hold it with no ammunition. And although they say fight to the last round and to the last man, there didn't seem much point in fighting to the last man. So I ordered them to withdraw, but I think that was the hardest bit.
Because you felt it was so key. Whilst you were actually on the Gloucester Hill itself, were you kept informed by your commanding officers as to what was happening?
We saw the company commander, Mike Harvey, quite frequently. And we talked about what was going on, but I don't recall any briefing, for example, about tanks trying to relieve us or their failure to do so. We were there in a position fighting off Chinese, and what was going on elsewhere was not passed down to my level anyway.
Was there anything at all exhilarating at any time to the fighting?
No, I don't think so. It was a situation in which one put into practice the training, no matter how short it had been as a national serviceman, that one had received. And that, plus all the war films one had seen in the war, the Second World War, and the circumstances of the time where one was doing a job made it not exhilarating at all. It was a noisy, tiring, frustrating, and sometimes a bit frightening situation. Exhilaration, I don't think, didn't come into it, at least not for me.
Did being in battle turn out to be just as you'd expected? Or?
Yeah, almost exactly. One has to bear in mind that the Chinese had no air force and very little artillery, and they relied upon mass tactics of infantry. And it felt as though the entire Chinese army was marching over my platoon and company. So to that extent we were spared bombardment from the air and a great deal of artillery harassment, and one was dealing with massed infantry. So there was nothing new, really, not even for a young man like myself.
You said earlier that you respected their bravery, but was there any temptation to hate the enemy?
To hate them?
Yes.
No, none at all. One out of the line before the battle and after it, hated them, perhaps, or hated what they'd done in terms of destruction of the country, the bridges and the roads and the people and the city of Seoul, which I saw burning. But one was too busy when actually shooting at them to hate them.
Now, I interrupted your narrative with your saying about the regrouping. If you can tell me about that, please.
Sorry, regrouping?
The regrouping after the battle.
Oh, right. Well, we... dirty, covered in mud. Some of us with parts of uniforms gone. Very few of us with weapons by this time. Went back to where the battalion headquarters was and slept. Quite an emotional reception. Soldiers cried. A lot of backslapping, a lot of congratulating, a lot of questions about where were the others, what had happened to the others, which we didn't know. But basically we slept. We were very, very tired in our muddy uniforms. And the following day we got new uniforms and had a bath. And one thing that stands out in my mind to this day, bathing in a half wooden barrel with hot water supplied by little Koreans, and I took off my army watch to have a bath, and some Korean pinched it. We withdrew what was left of the battalion, which was only about, I think, 235 men out of what had been 900 and something, to a recuperation area. And there we recuperated. First of all, we went to the area of the Han bridges near Seoul. Vast stretch of sand through which the Han meandered, and over it enormous girder built iron bridges carrying railways. They were down, of course, they've been blown up, but the American engineers put in new bridges, temporary ones, roads for the roads, and we were guarding these. We were advised not to, certainly not to drink the Han River water, and not to bathe in it. And we didn't really know why, but I learnt the following day when, going to the other side of the bridge, I saw three bloated bodies lying on the river shore. We were there with a troop of tanks, and I think they were Royal Tank Regiment crocodiles, in other words, flame-throwing tanks. I never saw those in action. And then we retired from there to a place where we could probably regroup, and an enormous amount of reinforcements poured in. They came from every conceivable regiment. And I recall receiving about half a dozen Scotsmen wearing Glengarry bonnets, and they were very, very ill-disciplined and refused to take off their bonnets because they were Scots. But we got over that, and they wear the blueberry thereafter. And that little lot needed training, and we proceeded to train them. It was at this place that I enjoyed my 20th birthday, and we trained them in weapon training and minor tactics and section drills and so on, and it all culminated in an exercise called Phoenix, a battalion attack on a hill, a range of hills. And excellent training it was, too. It was a very good battalion attack with all live ammunition, including artillery. And out of it emerged a new battalion, which very soon went up the line again. From that position, the commanding officer, who was now the Digby Grist, who had been the second in command at Imjin, sent me in a truck back to the Imjin positions. Remember, as a result of the Gloucester's action, and must remember the Belgian battalion and the Northumberland Fusiliers and the Royal Ulster Rifles, all in 29 Brigade, who fought just as hard as anybody. And the division and the realigned UN troops, as a result of all that, the Chinese spring offensive was stopped. And they were pushed back again. And so very soon they were back across the Imjin River, and the Gloucester's original positions were free again. And I was sent by the battalion commander back, and this was in mid-May, I suppose, to try to find the dead. And after various adventures, in a sea of mud, I recall, at one stage, in which the 1500 weight in which I was travelling slid sideways into a ditch and was pulled out by a passing American truck, we reached the area, which was then held, strange enough, by a Greek battalion. And there I met a young Greek officer who spoke very little English, and I spoke no Greek. And he handed over to me a few identification discs from, taken from bodies that he'd found in the area, lost as soldiers. And I looked around and found many of the dead myself and took their identification papers. And
just,
I said...
Just unburied?
Hmm?
Just unburied.
Oh, completely unburied, rotting. I mean, it was now May, really quite hot, and the bodies had been out in the sun for a long time. It was very, very unpleasant. I saw one body with the head nearly severed, and inside the head was a swarm of bees. I said to the Greek lieutenant how proud and honoured I was to serve alongside a Greek battalion, and he said something similar. And all that took place on what had been C Company's position. And I went back to my own company position and found my own soldiers' bodies, and they had been not buried either. So I took their identity discs and we began to bury them as well on the spot. And strange enough, in my own slit trench I found my own blueberry. During the battle I was wearing a cap comforter, one of these woolen things that is both warm and not a target. And I'd left my berry in the slit trench, and the back badge was missing. You know, the Gloucesters wear a badge front and back, and the back badge was missing, and I couldn't believe that a Chinese would have souvenir hunted a back badge without taking the front one. And I asked around, and a shamefaced corporal who was with me said, "Oh, well, I took it." He didn't know it was mine, of course, but he gave it back to me, and I've still got both badges. We then went on to the final hill looking for bodies there. And by this time I'd been joined by a new padre who joined the battalion and another officer from the Gloucesters. And we've together found several bodies. And the place was littered with tins, I recall. And I learned that it had been occupied by a French battalion recently, and they're not very good at tidying up after them, the French. So, having done what I could there, I rejoined the battalion.
Did your old positions look as you'd remembered them, or?
Oh, yes. It was only a month later, after all. And, yes, there were no weapons, of course, there. They'd all been taken. And such kit as we'd had left behind. I remember I'd left some chocolate in my trench, for example. I was a great chocolate eater in those days. All that had gone. Just the bodies, really. Disintegrating. So it was really quite the same. Yes. And then I rejoined the battalion, and we moved forward again, not quite to the same positions, but just behind them, a bit to the south of them. And there we built new defensive positions. And having completed them with more wire than I've ever seen in my life, a day or two after completing them, we moved out again, moved a bit further forward. And it ended up on a hill, so far as I was concerned, it ended up on a hill called 414, where we built another defensive position and dug in and stayed there. By this time, of course, my platoon had been regenerated with reinforcements. And it was from there that I departed because my national service was finishing. And I think it was in June, end of June.
I think you put here on this form that your national service ended August.
Yes, but I left that position at the end of June and was sent back and it's strange, I can't remember where I was sent back to, and I can't remember whether, I think I must have returned to Japan by air, at least to an airfield from which I went by boat back to Kure in a launch, I recall. And I also recall that in the rear areas of Korea, where I had to stay overnight, and I think in an American camp before moving on, at this time there was more firing than there was in the front line. And it was the Americans practicing. I mean, practicing. I think they were firing off bullets for the sake of firing off bullets. Not very well disciplined. Anyway, I returned to Kure, where I stayed for about 2 weeks, I suppose, and then boarded the Empire Orwell troop ship, which sailed for Hong Kong. For some reason it stayed there for 3 or 4 days, so I saw something of Hong Kong. And then we sailed for UK, and I was back in the UK in time to be demobilised, so to speak, on the 18th of August, exactly 2 years to the day from starting national service.
In the recent Gulf War that we had in 1991, we had a lot about the after effects of battle for the troops, and a lot of people were saying that it was very bad that people hadn't been counselled after the battle and all that type of thing. What are your own feelings about that issue after your experience in the Korean War?
There was no counselling, and so far as I'm aware, there was not the slightest need for it after my experience in the Korean War. Well, not for me, at any rate. and I don't know of any soldiers who needed it. Now, that may not be true in the case of the soldiers who were taken prisoner and cruelly treated for 2 or 3 years, and underwent terrible strains, both physically and mentally. And whether they needed it, I don't know. I don't think there was any organisation, even for them, however, to do it. And I truly have wondered, after the Gulf War and the reports of soldiers breaking down and making up stories and needing counselling, I've truly wondered how the army has changed, or people have changed, or society has changed from my day to the Gulf War. There was no question of counselling, I don't. And I firmly believe there was not much call for it.
Did you ever hear of any people who had been in the battle who were having nightmares or breakdowns or anything of that kind?
Well, I had a nightmare 2 or 3 weeks after the affair, still in Korea, still in the field, in which I distinctly heard trumpets, bugles blowing at night, and I woke up saying, "Here they come," and my friends around me grinning at me saying, "What's going on?" But that was the only effect of that kind that I experienced myself. I didn't hear of any others, no, except, as I say, one or two cases of prisoners of war who maybe had something more dramatic to have nightmares about.
So you mean you just left the nightmare off?
Yeah, it never happened again.
So that was the end of your national service. Can you tell me how you came to be a regular?
Well, I returned to being a civil servant in the Admiralty and found I couldn't bear it. The life was simply not for me after experiencing something of the world and something of warfare. And I'd always wanted, as I mentioned earlier, to be a soldier. And so I applied in the September, that is about a month after demobilisation, for a commission, a regular commission. And I was accepted into the Gloucesters. And on the 17th of December that same year, I rejoined the Gloucesters. And in time to receive them, to receive the battalion when it arrived back from Korea as a whole. And thereafter I served with them for another 9 years, before transferring into the intelligence corps.
What did army life give you which your brief experience of civil service life didn't, apart from the opportunity to travel?
I think chiefly it gave me independence. That may seem a strange thing to say in a disciplined service where you take orders, but being an army officer allowed me to think for myself, to make decisions, to organise others towards carrying out decisions for the common benefit, which I don't think I could have done in the civil service.
Did fighting under the UN flag make much difference to you, do you think?
We were very proud of it. We were very proud to be part of the English contingent, mind you, and I remember asking my family to send out a Union Jack so that we could identify ourselves, because we didn't wear blue berets, of course, in those days. It was declared a United Nations war, and it was American-led, but undoubtedly it was a United Nations war. But this was before the days of blue berets. It wasn't a peacekeeping operation, after all. It was a peace-enforcing operation. It was an anti-communist operation, if you like, led by the Americans, but under the aegis of the United Nations.